The Recollections of N. Balaram Reddy, Part 5. Bhagwan's Love and Care. It is hard to describe, and it was a wonder to see how Bhagwan bound all with his love. Between Bhagwan and some of his long-standing devotees, words would never pass. Nevertheless, these devotees, whether men, women or children, knew that Bhagwan's love and grace was being showered on them. By a single glance, a nod of the head, or perhaps by a simple inquiry from Bhagwan, sometimes not even directly but through a second person, the devotees knew that he was their very own and he cared for them. In his presence, all distinctions and differences were resolved. We lived together like a huge family with Bhagwan at the center, guiding us and shedding his grace and blessings on all. Bhagwan was most considerate and kind-hearted, but at the same time, he was a strict disciplinarian. Even if he appeared indifferent to the onlookers, he still took a keen interest in the progress of seekers, particularly if they happened to be youngsters. Many times I was helped by Bhagwan. Later, for instance, due to a crisis in my home, I was informed that my continuous presence in the village was now required. That meant I would have to leave Bhagwan for good. When I received this news, I went and explained it all to Bhagwan, who kindly listened and then simply nodded his head. The meaning of this nod I understood only upon receiving a letter from my mother, who wrote that I need not leave the presence of Bhagwan and that she would attend to all the affairs in the village. This was a turning point in my worldly life, and it was due, no doubt, to the direct intervention of Sri Bhagwan's grace. When I showed my mother's letter to Bhagwan, he read it and gave me a benign smile as if to say, "Are you now satisfied?" It was a mystery to see how he was so detached from the ashram and its operation, but yet was still somehow getting everything done as he wished. The Sarvadhikari Sri Niranjananda Swami once told me, "It is difficult for others to understand, but sometimes I feel there is something like a wireless connection between me and Bhagwan." Niranjananda Swami, Bhagwan's brother, had to endure considerable criticism while managing the ashram. Even so, there is little doubt that Bhagwan used him as his instrument. When Niranjananda Swami felt an inner prompting from Bhagwan, he confidently acted on it. The following may be an example of one such occasion. It is widely known that Paul Brunton's book, A Search in Secret India, did much to make known to the world that Maharishi, a unique sage of the century, was living in Tiruvannamalai. Brunton was a professional writer, and in those days, wherever he would go, he would often be seen taking notes on bits of paper. While in the old hall, listening to questions put to Bhagwan and his replies, he would be eagerly taking notes. After the success of A Search in Secret India, he began writing many other books in which he would sometimes adopt the Maharishi's teachings without giving due acknowledgement. When the ashram authorities realized this, they decided to stop him from taking notes in the hall. One day in 1939, Brunton was sitting next to me taking notes as usual when Niranjananda Swami boldly walked into the hall, stood next to Bhagwan and told Munagalla Venkatramaya to tell Brunton in English that he is no longer permitted to take notes while sitting before Bhagwan. Brunton was told accordingly. Brunton looked at Venkatramaya and said, "Is this also Bhagwan's view?" Venkatramaya did not reply to this question, and Bhagwan, who was quietly sitting there, didn't say a word either. A few tense moments passed, then Brunton stood up and left the hall. That was the last time he took notes in the hall, and that was also when Brunton began distancing himself from the ashram. It was very unusual to see the Sarvadhikari appear so bold and authoritative before the Maharishi. He must have felt that this exploitation should stop and was confident that Bhagavan was behind him, correcting proofs and settling in the ashram. It was perhaps a year or two later when I was preparing to make a trip back to my village when Bhagavan asked me to check through the proofs of the fourth edition of Self-Realization written by B.V. Narasimha Swami. I was in the hall and getting ready to take leave of Bhagavan when the final proofs, we called them strike forms back then, for the fourth edition of Self-Realization were handed over to Bhagavan. He called me, handed over the proofs and requested me to go through them. I thought it odd that although Bhagavan knew I was planning to leave that day, he would detain me with some work. It is said in the scriptures that the Guru blesses his Shishyas, disciples, by giving them work to do. And so I naturally felt blessed at his request, especially because he would rarely ask any one of us to do anything for him. When I had gone through one proof, another would arrive. And in this way, my trip home kept getting delayed. When I had finally finished all the strike forms and showed Bhagavan the errors, he expressed surprise and said, "I have gone through these proofs. Others have gone through them. And after all of this, Balaram Reddy finds more errors. The corrections I found had to be added in the end of the book under the title Errata." Completing this work, I returned to my village for the summer months. While I was there, the newly printed fourth edition of Self-Realization arrived at my house by post. The book was inscribed with the blessings of Sri Bhagavan. Perhaps Bhagavan had reminded the office that I had worked on the proofs and requested them to send me the new release. I have preserved that book in my village. When I returned at the end of the summer, the ashram administration, for some reason, made a change in their policy regarding my residence in the ashram. It was my regular practice to stay a few days in the ashram and then settle into some rented room in town. This time, the management favored me by letting me remain in the ashram itself. I placed my things in the northeast corner of the guest house for gentlemen. The ashram kindly gave me a very large, thick Malaysian mat woven with the split bamboo to spread on the floor. I hung carpets on the west and south sides and thus created my own simple room, which I found quite comfortable. I believe I may have been at that time the only devotee allowed to live in the ashram and not required to do some form of service or make payments. All this happened in a natural, spontaneous manner. It was as if the ashram had accepted me as a family member, and when we visit our home, where do we stay? Not in some rented room. How fortunate I felt. It was all Bhagavan's grace. Sanskrit. In my youth, when I was attending a Christian school, I began to study Sanskrit. However, the school decided to drop this subject from the curriculum soon after my studies began. Later in life, when I left the university and directed all my attention toward the spiritual ideal, I resumed studying Sanskrit on my own. But for some reason or other, these studies didn't proceed well either, and I soon dropped them. Then, when I settled down at Aurobindo Ashram, I again thought I should take up the study of Sanskrit. The main focus in language at Aurobindo Ashram was to improve our proficiency in English, not Sanskrit. And although I did improve my English considerably at Pondicherry, Sanskrit studies remained an unfulfilled aspiration. One evening, after I had settled in Bhagavan's ashram, I saw two large volumes and an oil lamp on the stool next to Bhagavan's couch. I asked Bhagavan what those books were. He told me that they were two volumes of Yoga Vasishtam, a famous Sanskrit text, and then went on to extol the wisdom of the verses in the books. Regretting my inability to learn Sanskrit, I told Bhagavan that although I had attempted to learn the language 3 times to that day, I had learned very little. He kindly replied, "I don't know much either. I don't even know Rama Sabda, the first rule of Sanskrit grammar." This encouraged me to learn more Sanskrit in Bhagavan's presence, especially as I noticed how Bhagavan took great interest in Sanskrit compositions and was all praise for Ganapati Muni's mastery over the language. One time, a Sanskrit professor from Annamalai University was in the hall speaking to Bhagavan in Sanskrit. Bhagavan could understand spoken Sanskrit but didn't speak it himself. He was closely following what the professor was saying, and I, sitting nearby, was also able to grasp most of what was being said. When this had gone on for some time, all of a sudden, I lost the thread of the conversation. At that very moment, Bhagavan turned to me and asked, "Did you follow that?" I was amazed how he caught me at the very moment I got lost. Once, Bhagavan mentioned about a Sanskrit biography of Saint Manikavachakar. The particular book he was speaking about was a transliteration of the Sanskrit text into Telugu. Some of his devotees took it upon ourselves to locate this book and bring it to Bhagavan. We searched long and hard, as it was out of print for many years. Finally, we were able to secure a copy from the estate of an influential zamindar landholder. When we presented it to Bhagavan, he seemed pleased and then asked me to begin reading aloud in the hall. I began, and as the time passed, Bhagavan's head leaned back on the pillow and his eyes shut. An old devotee of Bhagavan, one Subba Rao, sitting by my side, signaled to me to stop reading, as it looked obvious that Bhagavan had dozed off. I didn't stop immediately, but after his repeated silent requests, I stopped. The instant I stopped, Bhagavan opened his eyes, looked at me and asked why I stopped. Usually, we could not tell if Bhagavan was asleep or awoke, though in reality, he was always awake, awake to the self. Sometimes, we would approach his couch, see him reclining with his eyes shut, and softly say, "Bhagavan." I suppose we thought if we spoke softly and he didn't hear us, it meant that he was sleeping, and if he did hear us, he would respond without us disturbing him, as he was obviously awake and just resting his eyes. But however we reasoned, whenever we approached him in this manner, he would immediately open his eyes and say, "Yes, what is it?" The Sanskrit recitation of the Vedas morning and evening in Bhagavan's presence was usually well attended. Initially, some priests from the main temple in town began coming and reciting before Bhagavan, thinking perhaps it was edifying for them to do this in the august presence of the Maharishi. Although everyone liked this, it was not performed with any consistency, depending mostly on the whims of the priest. The Sarvadhikari thought the ashram should have similar daily parayanas in a routine way. With this end in mind, a Veda Patasala or Vedic school was established in the ashram. The students, much like today, would come twice a day and recite before the Maharishi. Now, the only difference is that they recite before Bhagavan's tomb. Bhagavan often commented on the value of listening to the Vedic chants, we would normally see him fully alert and absorbed throughout the duration of these recitations. In 1942, Bhagavan was near the back steps of the ashram when he abruptly placed his stick before the path of a dog that was in hot pursuit of a squirrel. In this successful attempt to save the squirrel, he lost his balance and fell, fracturing his right shoulder. Soon after this incident, when I was taking leave of Bhagavan to visit my village, I looked at the bandaged shoulder and wanted to ask him how he was feeling. But how could I? I knew perfectly well what his reaction would be to such a question regarding his physical well-being. Reaching my village, I wrote a letter to Bhagavan in which I quoted the following verse. It is improper to make inquiries about the health and welfare of those whose sole delight is in the self, since they are strangers to those mental states which distinguish between weal and woe. Srimad Bhagavata, Skanda 4, Chapter 22, Verse 14. In addition to this, I also included a short Sanskrit verse that I composed. When I returned to the ashram, one of Bhagavan's attendants told me that on the day my letter arrived, Bhagavan removed it from the other letters and put it by his side. He later returned all the letters except mine. Subsequently, he asked the attendant to bring him the big notebook in which all the verses composed on Bhagavan were recorded. Then, in his own hand, he copied the Sanskrit verse I composed into the notebook. He not only copied the Telugu script which I had written in it, but also transliterated it into the Devanagari script. Then, with a reading pen, he artistically framed the verses using two close parallel lines, one thicker than the other. The finished product looked like a piece of art. When I heard all this from the attendant and saw what Bhagavan had written in the book, I was very moved by the solicitude and attention he extended to me. Many years later, I asked President T.N. Venkatraman if I could cut out from that book my verse written by Bhagavan. He gave me permission, and I now keep it in my album containing photos of Bhagavan. Below is a copy of what Bhagavan wrote in the notebook, followed by my English translation. I salute Ramana, who shines by the effulgence of the self, who delights in non-action, and whose life purifies the world. In January of 1946, Bhagavan came across a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam that seemed to have appealed to him immensely. He first found it in the Tamil Bhagavatam and then searched and found it in the original Sanskrit Srimad Bhagavatam. He then made his own Tamil rendering of it and, at my request, translated it into Telugu, my mother tongue. Because Bhagavan was giving this verse so much time and attention, I naturally thought it must convey a special meaning, especially in regard to his own spiritual experience. The literal translation in English is, "The body is impermanent, not real. Whether it is at rest or moves about, and whether by reason of prarabdha it clings to him or falls off from him, the self-realized Siddha is not aware of it, even as the drunken man, blinded by intoxication, is unaware whether his cloth is on his body or not." Bhagavan showed me his Telugu translation and asked me to correct it. When I protested, saying, "How can I correct Bhagavan's writing?" he simply said that he must take advice from those who are proficient in whatever language he happens to use. To be continued.